It is 23 minutes past the hour, and Dr. Don Clark joins us. Don is a biochemist and a vigneron, and spends a whole lot of time, because he lives there, down in Garden Valley, Texas, working among the grapevines and philosophizing and doing science. It was a great way to put his vocation to work there, I think, growing grapes. And he's also a member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don, happy Tuesday. Good morning. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. Good to be with you this morning.
Yeah.
And it's a warm morning down here, and it's raining. It's going to be a rainy day today.
How warm is warm?
Oh, 64.
Oh, that is warm.
60-ish, 64.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, believe it or not, it's warm up here, too, and it's 29.
And, oh, gee whiz.
And
wow.
And it's going to it's downright subtropical today, except the ground is white. And that makes it look colder than it really is. But somehow that's life in East Dakota. So we're used to it, and we're geared up for it and looking forward to a white Christmas. How do you prepare for Christmas down there in Texas where occasionally you see snow, don't you?
Well, we may get snow this Christmas, actually. This rain is bringing a weather front through. And after it passes, it will start to get cold, and it'll be down in the 20s here as well.
I know that a lot of homes down there are built on slabs. That means plumbing problems, probably, huh? Frozen pipes and slippery roads.
Well, if it freezes, certainly it'll be. It could be slippery roads, especially if it's, if we get some moisture, which we have now. Now, if later in the day it started freezing, that'd be a big problem.
Yeah,
but it looks like it's going to be fairly warm, actually, most of the day. All day. It's going to be warm.
Well, the cooler temperatures, I think, are welcome, because I visited down there in October, and a number of people come in and said, boy, I hope we, because, it was autumn, and they said, boy, I hope we have a cold winter. I said, wait a minute now. People are coming here for warmth. And you want a cold? And I said, well, yeah, because it gets rid of the bugs. They want to want to see the insects frozen off and disappear for at least a while. So I can understand that sentiment. We have a topic today that is a little different than what we normally take on. This is almost a more of a philosophical discussion than a scientific one. And it has to do with something called natural science. And what prompted this is I got an email from an organization from the Discovery Institute a few weeks ago, and it's now buried deep in my inbox someplace, and I couldn't find it. But it struck me. It talked about natural science and how the term, the concept, is a fairly recent move. I suppose in the last century it's come about. And so I looked up the definition, and on Wikipedia it says this about natural science. Natural science is a branch of science concerned with the description, prediction, and understanding of natural phenomena based on empirical evidence. There's the rub. From observation and experimentation, mechanisms such as peer review and repeatability of findings are used to try to ensure the validity of scientific advances. Well, Don, as I recall from my high school chemistry days and science days, things like, repeatability, that's part of the scientific method itself. And that does not necessarily mean the same thing as natural science. It means that you do an experiment, you get certain results, and you want to see if other people can repeat it and get the same results. And that's kind of like a witness, a validation of your experiment. But this limitation to empirical evidence, what does that do to science?
Well, it depends on what the evidence is, because you've got really two branches of natural science. One is life science, and the other one is physical science. The physical sciences are a little harder, because we're talking about physics, chemistry, earth sciences. Can be somewhat questionable, as well as space science. Physics, of course. The simplest, not necessarily the simplest physics, but, friction and movement and motion.
Acceleration, things like that.
Yeah, acceleration, all that. That's been worked out, for some time. But when you start getting into, let's say, quantum physics, for example, and it's very, very difficult to measure things, not much less measure them accurately. And you have to start assuming, making assumptions about how things are put together, for example. Then you basically wind up with a mathematical model trying to describe some squiggly lines on a photograph, for example, or gathering information from colliding particles.
Well, here's a question for you then. Would a mathematical calculation, a formula of some kind that predicts something, would that be considered empirical evidence?
The empirical evidence is that which you observe. I guess you would say that the empirical evidence in life sciences, for example, the empirical evidence that you're observing is perhaps an animal movement or animal migrations, and then you're trying to predict some type of reason why they migrate throughout the year and where they're going to migrate through to, and then trying to, describe that type of event. Now, with the hard sciences, which, physics and chemistry are, dumped into those categories, you are definitely observing things. I mean, you observe that water boils, for example. And then you come up with an instrument to measure, temperature. And also you need to know what the pressure is. And then, you can then say that, water boils at 100 degrees Celsius, for example, or centigrade. And but that's at a 1 atmosphere pressure. Now, you increase the pressure and the water boils at a higher temperature, and you can then do experiments where you take the water and you're heating it up, and you know how much heat you put in there, and you can get a very accurate description of the pressure temperature profile, for example, of when water boils, and you can describe that mathematically. So, that's, yes, you're watching, you're observing, you're collecting data, but you also are now introducing instruments that help you to get a more accurate, idea as to what the, in quote, empirical data is in this case.
Well, then here's a curve. Here's a curve I want to throw at you. What's the difference between how and why? It seems that data and mathematical formulas and experimentation and empirical evidence all describe the how of something. But when it comes to the why, you've got to assume things. You have to guess at the why, don't you?
It depends on what area of field you're talking about, but certainly in the natural sciences, in the life sciences, for example, you are making assumptions as to, or at least trying to make assumptions, hopefully intelligent assumptions as to why this animal behaves this way, or why are they migrating, or why they eat this type of food, and various things like that. So you are kind of assuming, or science. This is the thing about science. Science, you pretty much have to come up with a guess. Even in the physical sciences,
would that be termed an hypothesis?
A hypothesis. So, which normally says you come up with a null hypothesis. If this hypothesis, then you try to disprove it with your experiment, for example, or you try to prove it with your experiment, depending on what you're trying to do. So that's why the repeatability comes in. And you've got to be able to show that your hypothesis that you've made, and what you showed through maybe repeated experiments, that someone else can repeat that, does not necessarily mean that the hypothesis is correct, by the way. Mm-hmm. It just means that it's a possibility. It's one of perhaps many explanations as to that behavior or what you're observing is actually taking place. Now, when you start throwing in, mathematics, you then get in the mechanical side of things, and you have to assume that whatever observation or whatever that is changing, because mathematics likes to describe things that change, whatever's changing or what event that took place, that your model, and there again, there are assumptions that go into the model, will describe something that the best way of testing it is to for it to describe something that you haven't measured. And then, so it predicts, it predicts some event. And then you go back into the lab or out into the world and you say, have I observed this event? And are my conditions that I've set in my mathematical formula, correct such that it predicts it, with accuracy? And, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you go back and you tweak and you try to figure out why it doesn't. And you say, oh, well, I didn't account for this variable or I didn't account for that one. Or if it does, you say, well, at least, that within this limited range of experimentation that can be done, my model seems to be holding. But it doesn't necessarily mean that if you extrapolate out for a long period, for example, this is exactly what they do with evolution, that if you extrapolate this particular experiment that you've done and described with, with some equation, that it will indeed hold true far beyond the limits of your data. One of the things that they taught us in physics that makes a good physicist is that you've got to have a lot of data within your model for one thing. It's got to be reproducible for another thing, and you don't go too far beyond the limits of your available data to describe something new. But with evolution, they completely ignore that and say, well, we've got to describe something that happened millions and millions of years ago, if not billions of years. And so we're extrapolating way beyond the limits of any possible experimentation that we can do. And for some reason, that extrapolation is okay in with evolutionary thinking and discussions, because it's the only natural description that we have of how we came to be. So that's what that becomes acceptable.
Let me ask you this then. First of all, define data. Is it measurement? Is it numbers? Is it or is it other than numbers and I don't know what else it would be? Numbers.
Oh yeah. Well, it's you typically data. You're typically taking some type of physical measurement. For example, I monitor the temperature of my wines, and I've got I can look back in history over the whole history of that particular wine and see what the data, what temperature it has, it was at any given point in time. And, for example, if my chiller went out, then I'll get a notification that the temperature is rising, and I better go and investigate to see what's going on. So, in this case, the data is temperature versus time, for a certain thing. So I've got a temperature probe, and over time I'm taking measurements. And if I wanted to, I could, because it does fluctuate a little bit as the glycol valve open and closes on the tank, come up with some type of model as to, okay, I know exactly when this valve is going to open, for example, and I can use the data then in a predictive way to say, in 15 minutes the valve is going to open. And sure enough, that, you know, with the you measuring the outside temperature and the temperature of the tank, and watching the temperature of the tank increase slightly, and then the event takes place, and voila, the valve opened in 15 minutes. Is that rocket science? No, it's not rocket science. As a matter of fact, there's a computer in my temperature controller that is based on the mathematics.
So it all produces data. Does a creationist? Well, there's a body of data concerned with natural science. I'm looking at this dichotomy between creationism and evolution now. Do creationists and evolutionists dispute the data, or do they agree on the pure data?
Well, what's the data? That's the question. What are you looking at? Well, you're looking at animals that live today. You're looking at bones, that apparently lived in the past, exact past. We don't necessarily know. You're looking at fossils, that is, bones or remnants of animals that have been captured in clay that is turned to rock. In that process in itself, you're trying to guess as to how that event took place to bury something, for example, in mud, which then turns to rock, so that you could then get a picture of that creature, whether it be a leaf, whether it be a mammoth or whatever it happens to be, and then say, okay, this lived 450 million years ago. Now, that's where the hypothesis comes in. That's where the guessing is coming in, because you don't know how long, when is that fossil present.
Evolution would dispute that, though. They say, of course we know. We've radio or carbon dated, or we've matched this fossil with a rock layer over here, and that was matched with one over there, and we've decided it's old. It's the same age as those because it was in the same layer of rock. That's not data, is it?
It's information. You could say that it's data, but the assumption that goes into that, you see, there are two different assumptions. One, it says that it took a long time to lay that rock layer down, or that, in this case, the mud layer, whatever it happens to be, which has turned to rock. It took a long time for that to happen. Another assumption is no, because of the fact that you have these layers, those layers were laid down very, very quickly. And just because you have a animal buried in that particular layer doesn't mean that it was, a long time ago. That's where the assumptions come in. And that's what, colors your interpretation of the data, for example. Evolutionists don't really have a good idea as to why the Earth is covered with multiple layers, sometimes 6,000 feet deep of, sand and rocks and mud and that have turned to rocks. And we've got all of these geological layers. And all they can say is, well, those were laid down, obviously, over millions and millions of years. And in fact, the creationist model would say, no, most of those layers were laid down during the flood, or some of the upper layers were probably laid down as a result of the flood, but post-flood.
Possibly over several hundred years.
Yeah, over several hundred years, but certainly not over, millions of years. Mm-hmm. And so now you're kind of arguing about, what's the starting point, if you will. What is the starting assumptions? And the starting assumptions obviously can color your interpretation of the, end quote, data that you're seeing. And just as the little finch story we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where, oh my goodness, we've got a new species of finch. Well, all you're doing is reintroducing, you know, some DNA from a isolated finch from one island onto an isolated other finches from another island, and you're producing a crossbreed between two finches.
Variation within a kind, yes.
Variation within a kind that does not prove evolution. In fact, you have to start with a parent finch or a parentage of finches that have all of the DNA of the finches, and they get separated, isolated, because of the the events that have taken
place.
What
strikes me about that kind of an argument on the part of evolutionists is that they're grasping at straws. They are so intent upon destroying the creationist position and proving their own because they don't really believe it. I don't see how a so-called scientist can look at the body of information within the evolution realm and say that's good science. I can't imagine that. And yet the assumption is that it's true because it's science. It's science because it's true. It's circular logic.
It is very much circular logic, and I truly believe that they believe it because because they don't have any other explanation. Their other explanation is to admit that there is a God, and if you admit that there is a God, then either God is involved with man or he's not. He's involved with his creation or he's not, and then we can talk about, you know, religious philosophy or theological philosophies one way or the other. But at some point in time, if you admit that there is a God, then perhaps you might be accountable to this God, and he has certain rules and principles by which to live by. And if you don't want to live by those rules, then you're going to lean more towards saying that there is no God than opposed to yes, there is a God.
Well, then, to evolutionists everywhere on this Tuesday morning, I can say, surprise, you are not the top of the food chain.
We're not.
Let me tell you about an experiment I did. Maybe you can explain this, because I didn't do it real scientifically, but I did develop a theory. Now, David and I were talking about this on the air a few days ago. There was one day here back in 1995, 1996, where the temperature at night fell to 58 below zero.
Oh, wow.
I figured, what a perfect time to try this experiment. Because I'd heard what happens, and it doesn't have to be 58 below. It can be 20 below or 30 below. But what you do is you take a cup of boiling water, you know, hot off the stove, and you run outside where it's 58 below, and you throw it in the air, and you can see it pop and explode and fizz, and it does all kinds of wild things, and then it falls to the ground. If you do the same thing with a cup of cold water, it doesn't happen. So my theory is this: hot water freezes more rapidly than cold water. Can you either take that apart or verify it?
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting observation that you've made there. Yeah. So the cold water just falls to the ground cold, and then it takes a while.
Then it freezes. It could be seconds, but it's not instantaneous, you know.
Well, the hot water, what's happening with the hot water? The hot water is evaporating. And so the process of evaporation also cools the water down, and so you're getting the freezing process, if you will, perhaps boosted by the fact that the hot water is actually indeed evaporating, where your cooler water doesn't have an internal process for cooling itself down.
So you're saying that Park's law, that hot water freezes faster than cold, is in error then?
No. I mean, it could be, the observation could be right, because as you throw the water up, you've dispersed it from a big pot, for example, into smaller particles or into smaller bits of water,
and you could still see steam coming up from it. Yeah, and that's the part that crackles and snaps and almost sparks. I can't swear that there are sparks there, but you can hear it. It pops. Yeah. You can hear it. Yeah,
right.
So okay.
Well, is there any way to prove that or disprove it? Do you have to be up here when it's 58 below? I mean,
You can't do this in Texas. Anywhere in Texas, no, okay. It won't work. No, that's why they would have to.
You can mimic it actually with liquid nitrogen, because if you take a little bit of liquid nitrogen and throw it up in the air, it sounds and looks exactly like what you're describing.
Well, hey,
okay.
Oh, excuse me, Don. Thanks so much. Appreciate this discussion, and the whole idea of natural science just seems to be so self-limiting when you limit scientific experimentation to empirical evidence. But then maybe that's the only thing we can do. Our senses, our sight, sound, smell, taste, all those things are the only things we can really gather data by. But the evidence is so loud that the creator is there too, and it just needs to be part of the story. Don, have a great week. We'll see you after Christmas. No,
okay,
you know what?
Merry Christmas, Don.
We will not have a live morning show next week. So
you won't have it for next week, right, or next Tuesday,
but
right?
The week after. So we'll see you next year.
Okay, yeah. It will be next year. Yes, indeed. Y'all have a wonderful Christmas, and hope everybody listening also has a very merry Christmas.
And may God rest you merry as well. Take care. Bye.